This is an ABC podcast.
The story of Australia's most successful 19th century pedestrianist, or haunted island that shows up all your scars, and the island of Manhattan, where all your exes turn up to haunt you day after day. Hi, welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Kate Evans.
That is a bit of a nightmare scenario you just painted.
Oh, yeah,
I feel a little
hiding.
Unsettled.
I mean, just imagine if every day when you left the house, you bumped into an ex.
Oh, my God. It's almost like real life. And I'm Cassie McCullough. Hello. We're talking fiction, new fiction today on The Bookshelf. And that nightmare scenario that Kate just described happens to Lola, a 30-something cool-as-hell New Yorker in Sloane Crossley's cult classic. I wonder how long it takes for her to lose her cool.
Well, exactly. But, you know, I also heard her on The Big Weekend of Books talking to Claire Nichols, and so we'll hear some grabs from that. And it's writer and funeral director Jackie Bailey who'll read that one for us. But we'll head away from New York restaurants and go to a set of remote islands off the coast of Scotland as well in Eliza Henry Jones' Salt and Skin.
And critic Susan Windham has read that for us. But let's start with Robert Drew's latest novel. It's called Nimblefoot, and we're going to the horse races. The writer Robert Drew is especially associated with the sea. His short story collections include The Body Surfers, The Rip, and one of his memoirs is called The Shark Net. But he has 20 books or more to his name, so we won't list them all. Maybe you read A Cry in the Jungle Bar or The Drowner.
And Cassie, while he was born in Melbourne, he spent much of his life in Western Australia, which is where a considerable amount of his fiction is set, and he now lives between Western Australia and Northern New South Wales.
Although I just read that his archives and books and much more was inundated, wrecked in the recent floods in Northern New South Wales.
Yes, he had a terrible year, but in the midst of it, he's also explored a historical archive and expanded it, well, imagined it really, in his new novel, Nimblefoot.
Yes, now this story begins with a real character, a boy from Australian history, and we get a summary of his life on the first page.
You read it for us, Cassie.
Okay, all right, I'll read it. Here we go. This is a tale of Johnny Day, his country's first and youngest international sporting champion. By the age of 10 and against adult competition, he was an undefeated champion walker, the so-called famous boy and pedestrian child wonder and the child phenomenon for Australia and furthermore, the champion of the world. Then, as a 14-year-old jockey and in record time, he won the 1870 Melbourne Cup on a horse called Nimblefoot. He was feted by royalty. Then, Johnny Day dropped out of sight. People wondered what had happened to him. Wild stories started up. And we're off.
So this is a novel based in a real life, and then it spins away. But I spoke to Robert Drew and I asked him how he encountered this world-famous pedestrianist, and this is what he said.
I was in the National Library in Canberra, and there was an exhibition on which was a display of the possessions of an English former New Zealand collector called Rex Nankivell, and it was called The Famous and the Infamous. And amongst the portraits of the usual people like Captain Cook and so forth, and Truganinny and bushrangers, there was this picture of this little tiny boy leaning on a milepost. You know, I asked the organisers who he was and what had he done, and they said he was the world champion pedestrian. And then they outlined the sport and what he'd done. He was competing against adult males from the ages of 9 to 12. He made £30,000 sterling, which would equate now to $8 million, racing and winning. He ran in 101 races and didn't lose one, which I thought was absolutely extraordinary. But what made it more extraordinary was that they then said he retired before he turned 13, and a year later, as an apprentice jockey, won the Melbourne Cup. And I looked that up, and that was true, on a horse, if you could imagine this, called Nimblefoot.
And so from this glimpse, I guess, of a history, we're off and running into an imaginative world. And Robert Drew takes us right there in the opening pages to this boy racer. And it's fascinating and sort of odd, because not only is this boy going on these very, very long walking races, I mean, it starts off, here's the first line, "The Moscow maestro is wearing a nanny goat around his neck like a scarf." And that is just one of the other characters competing in this race. Well, it's this odd scenario on this, what he calls a hot and humming afternoon. There's another character racing in his gumboots. We get the details of the crowd, the advertising, the sort of dust in your throat. And there we are at this race. And then we flip back and we get the background of this boy and who he is in Ballarat. His father is a butcher. And so we go back and forth in this character's life, I guess.
Okay, so we're going back into the middle of the 19th century in Australia, and a sense of maybe pantomime and vaudeville and entertainment.
Well, entertainment, Lola Montez, the famous spider dancer, is a bit of a side character in this story, because Johnny Day's father had been to see her perform. So he's peppering this novel with real characters and places and using what it is he can find out about this child. But, I mean, I think it is right to call it a picaresque novel that is going through these episodic movements in a life. And the style is lively and almost cartoonish at times, but we're getting, well, you can see how our sense of Australia's history has changed, because we need to look closely at the Chinese workers, at Aboriginal people in the landscape, at the way that women are treated. And all of this is done in creating this, what feels like a tall story, but as we know from that very first page, it is based on a real character.
And or what he could find of a real character.
What he could, yes, because then it goes somewhere else. So the first couple of chapters follow the story as far as we know it. But again, with that eye for detail. So, you know, his father was a butcher. Mm-hmm. And so there's a sense of this sort of masculine world of blood and violence in a way, and then that is being contrasted with his mother, who is giving birth with the help of her son. So we're going into the family, and in that first chapter I was completely drawn into this world, and then suddenly we were flung out of it, and it was 4 or 5 years later, and now he's a jockey. Well, and he eventually rides the horse that wins the Melbourne Cup. And there's all sorts of subterfuge behind the scenes as well, as he gets caught up in the sort of the wealthy in Melbourne and seeing things he shouldn't see. And at around about that point is where Robert Drew runs out of the historical record and can let his imagination go.
Okay. So a gear shift.
A gear shift that lost me briefly, and then I was back in. And I was back in the saddle, because this is a chase novel. Mm-hmm. So I guess the question that he's asking and that is being answered by the novel is, why did he disappear? What happened to him? Where did he go? And so he's escaping and hiding from something. But when he hits the road, it means that his travelling through all these landscapes, through quarantine hospitals, coastal camps with Chinese workers, cattle stations, timber getters, meeting a lot of characters. And one of the things that you start to really notice in this book is how short the chapters are. So there's quite a pace to it, but you're also getting these fragmentary images, and they're very compelling and very vivid. So you'll meet a character, you know, a snake handler in a pub, who's only there for that one scene and then disappears again, which of course happens in life. Mm. You know, we see something remarkable and then we move on. And so we get a lot of that as Johnny or Jack or whatever name he's taken by moves across the country.
So we're on a journey. We're learning more about this imagined life of this young boy, Johnny. Does the play between the fiction and the factual continue?
It continues in quite interesting ways. There's something of the tall tale about it. But you are also thinking about Australian history and representation because there are actual writer characters who appear in the novel. So Adam Lindsay Gordon, the poet, is in there, and there is a good reason for him to be there. It's not just because we are travelling across bookshelves as well as landscapes. And Anthony Trollope appears in it as well. And probably the easiest way to do this actually is to get Robert Drew to explain why these characters appear in the book.
He in fact, did work at Craig's Hotel when Adam Lindsay, the real Johnny, when Adam Lindsay Gordon was there. So that was sort of a gift in a way. So that wasn't made up. And Anthony Trollope did come to Australia and to Western Australia at that time. So that, in a sense, wasn't made up. But I also wanted to show how Australia was viewed by, an English toff, who was also a writer, and I wanted to show how Australia was viewed by a poet with bad luck. It was Adam Lindsay Gordon, who in fact was a very good steeplechase rider himself, probably the best in Australia, but who was too vain to wear glasses. And so while he could clear obstacles in a steeple race, would ride headfirst into a lamppost and that sort of thing and concuss himself constantly. So all this was sort of interesting and also a bit funny, I thought. And I wanted both those things to come across.
And they did come across. I mean, he has an eye for those strange moments. And although we're getting the drama of this young man who is in some ways in fear for his life and in some ways in fear for his future, there's a real sense of joy in this story and a sense of a vivid, well-imagined life with these striking moments. So they're almost hyper-real. In the novel, there's an abattoir on the coast of Western Australia with the blood pouring down into the sea. And again, this is a real thing. This is how we treated our, when industrial landscapes met the sea. But there's something about the way that he describes it that sort of brings out the oddness of all of this.
Yeah, interesting. It's making me think of Peter Carey, another great older statesman of Australian writing, and that most recent book of his, A Long Way From Home, which was also a journey around Australia and in a way re-examining things that he may have overlooked in his career as a writer before. Maybe there's a resonance there.
Yes, one in a car, one on foot or with a horse. Now, it did nearly lose me at the beginning, partly because I was so taken with this childhood image of the pedestrianist. And then once I took a deep breath and realised we were on a different type of journey, then I was back with it and with images that will stay with me. A Chinese lion dance over a headland for imprisoned friends, horses racing into the surf. And that's Robert Drew's Nimblefoot, published by Hamish Hamilton. But Cassie, while this is a novel that draws on and plays with the archive, we did talk about the fact that Robert Drew lost his own archive in the flood. You know, this is what happened.
I lost all my own books, archives, files, computer, anything, all the wiring, of course, modems and stuff on the floor was underwater. And, of course, the mould had spread throughout the house. And anyone from the Northern Rivers knows it's like an alien invasion when this black mould just sort of crawls up your walls and gets in your clothes. And, we threw out three skips full of seeing your own books and others by famous overseas writers just being chucked away. I had first editions of Gabriel Garcia Marquez and others that I just had to throw away, which was, really, really saddening.
Robert Drew talking about his recent loss in the Northern Rivers flooding and, our hearts go out to everybody who's been touched by that calamity. Just heartbreaking.
Yes, many heartbreaking things this year for Robert Drew, but he wrote his way through it.
You're listening to ABC RN's The Bookshelf, where it's time to meet this week's guests. Susan Windham is with us, journalist, critic, former literary editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. Susan, great to have you back reading books for us.
Lovely to be here. Thanks, Cassie. Thanks, Kate.
Hi, Susan.
Now, you were one of the judges for this year's Age Book of the Year Prize. Now, that was established in 1974 and went for years and years and then had a 9-year break before it kicked off again last year. In the fiction section, what were you looking for?
Literary merit, always. Originality of voice and story and style, but a book that coheres somehow and does what it's trying to do with real integrity and dash. And we certainly found it. We ended up with a very diverse shortlist. The winner's not going to be announced until the opening of the Melbourne Writers' Festival in September, but our shortlist is out. Would you like to know what's on it?
We would love that.
So in alphabetical order, these are all novels. In Moonland by Miles Allenson, Cold Enough for Snow by Jessica Owl, After Story by Larissa Berendt, The Signal Line by Brendan Colley, Bodies of Light by Jennifer Down, which of course just won the Miles Franklin Award, and Love and Virtue by Diana Reid. All quite interesting and different, but with a very strong travel theme running through it, which was interesting in this non-travel period of our lives.
Well, including a ghost train, I notice, with Signal Line by Brendan Colley. And Susan, we've actually read 5 of the 6 and discussed them here on the bookshelf. The only one that we missed, actually, was Miles Allenson's In Moonland. So tell us about that one.
Oh, well, I highly recommend it. It's Miles's second book, and he's run under the radar a bit, but God, he's a terrific writer. In Moonland is about a young Melbourne man whose father has died, and he feels he never really knew his father, and he sets out to try and talk to his friends and people who knew him at different stages in his life and piece together who he was. And central to the father's character and life was a period he spent in the 1970s in India with the Bhagwan, you know, Rajneesh, the guru up there who
turned bad,
the orange man. And that whole sort of hippie period of the father's life is clouded in mystery and drugs. You know, no one can quite remember what happened. So the son sets out to retrace the father's steps, and it's such a brilliant critique of all that idealistic, spiritual 70s hoo-ha. Very good.
So that's In Moonland by Miles Allenson, just one of 6. Is it 6?
Yeah, 6
on your shortlist for the Age Book of the Year prize, which will be, the winner will be announced later this year.
Yeah, in September. Also, there's a non-fiction prize this year, which I didn't judge, but they've brought that back this year too, so look out for that.
Well, and I noticed that in the non-fiction shortlist includes Bernadette Brennan, who's been a guest here on the bookshelf, for her book Leaping into Waterfalls, The Life of the Writer Gillian Mears, which just earlier this week won the biography prize.
Yeah, the National Biography Award, which is administered by the New South Wales State Library. And, yeah.
Wonderful news.
Yes.
A beautiful book.
$25,000, not bad. And the memoir prize, the Michael Crouch Prize for a first-time person in that category was won by Armani Haider for The Mother Wound. So,
great.
So many books, and even the ones that we mentioned like this in passing will be listed on the bookshelf website. But also here with us is novelist and independent funeral director Jackie Bailey. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Jackie.
Hello. Hi.
You have written a book called The Eulogy, which obviously, you know, is informed by this work. It only just came out a couple of months ago. Now, it's a story about, well, family and loss and love. Is it a novel?
Yeah, it's a novel. They're classifying it as autofiction, which is, you know, just autobiographical fiction. And that's a term that we borrowed from Michael Muhammad Ahmed, who I'm pretty sure you've spoken to or spoken about.
Yes.
Yeah, a book that draws a lot on my life, but things like me escaping a kidnapping charge, not true for anyone out there with small children. You know, things like that. So just to make it more dramatic. And also there's stuff that I wanted to explore, a bit like you were describing with Miles Allenson's book. But for me, it was trying to find out more about both my parents. My dad was in Vietnam and Malaya in the army, and my mum grew up in Singapore under the Japanese occupation. And they never spoke about it, but I wanted to know more about it. So fiction gives you that opportunity.
Wow, incredible background.
So fiction allowed you to explore things that a straight memoir you might have felt constrained by?
Yeah, exactly. And also, if you're a writer of colour, there's a bit of pressure to write memoir, and I really didn't want to. So I did a PhD to make myself write this book. And in the sort of theoretical side of things, I was researching the way that different types of books are received by readers. And there's all this research that shows that people come to fiction with a different sort of stance. Super interesting if you're an academic nerd. And I wanted that open, vulnerable stance. And it's also a stance of equals, whereas with nonfiction memoir, especially by a person of colour, it can be a different sort of relationship. It can be a bit more of a patronising type of colonising relationship. Not for everybody, of course, but it was very important to me to not have that vibe.
Wow, so many things that you've brought up for us there. And just connecting back to your work on loss and death, I think there are going to be some connections of that in the novels that we're reading today. So why don't we turn to those? So Jackie, you read the New York novel Cult Classic by Sloane Crossley. And Susan, you've read Eliza Henry Jones' Salt and Skin. And to get ready for that one, well, we're going to have to get onto a boat. We might even have to get our feet wet.
Eliza Henry Jones has written four novels before the one we're about to hear about, including two which were for young adults. She's also a PhD candidate and apparently lives on a flower farm. How wonderful. Which may or may not have an impact on her writing, but who could resist that detail? She's also Australian, but her new novel, Salt and Skin, is set in the far north of Scotland, off the coast in an archipelago. So, Kate, you and Susan need to transport us to where we need to be.
Well, this novel takes us to these places in the north of Scotland, to its mythologies and stories and characters. And I imagined my way into these sort of cold sea mists as I was reading. But Susan, you've spent time in this part of Britain, haven't you?
I mean,
is it a family connection for you?
Yes, I have family connections with the Shetland Islands, which are the northernmost islands of Britain, way up north of the mainland. And Eliza Henry Jones has, I know, travelled to Orkney, which is between the mainland and Shetland. And she has fictionalised that wonderful wild landscape for her islands that are the setting of the novel. And I could certainly relate to the landscape and the whole atmosphere that she creates. I've spent quite a lot of time in Shetland and it's windblown. The islands are almost treeless and there are these great steep jutting cliffs and lots of seabirds and
fantastic.
Sheep. And it's very, very beautiful.
Let's turn to the fictional place in Eliza Henry Jones's book, Salt and Skin. So it's a contemporary novel and an Australian woman has come to the island with her two children, Darcy and Min. The woman's name is Luda. So who are they? Why are they there?
They're an Australian family. Luda is a photographer and her children, Darcy is 16 and Min is 14. And the father of the family, Joshua, has recently died in what seems to be a car accident. And they have come from rural Australia where their farm was suffering very badly from drought. And they were under the pressure that we know rural people have been under for some years. And they've kind of run away from the difficult situation they were in, from the grief that they're all processing in their different ways. And they've come to Shawnee, where Luda has a family connection. I think it's her great-great-great-grandparents came from there. And she has an elderly relative, Cassandra, who has found her a job and a house to live in on Shawnee. It's the only house still standing amid the rubble of all the other old stone places. And she's in this house that's connected to the big island by a causeway, and it's known as the Ghost House. So they step straight into this wild landscape and a place of legend and myth and superstition. And Luda wants to work as a photographer. She has a job with the council and she wants to photograph the effects of climate change on the islands which are being eroded by the gales. The storms seem to be getting worse. And so this is her great passion. And it seems she's so distracted by her desire to kind of save the world that she almost doesn't notice what her children are going through sometimes.
And then as the book opens, the family is on a boat with a local man called Ewan, and they're sort of orienting them to the place and they're looking at it. And, well, as they're in the water, they see a woman and a child walking along the shore. And then there's a crack, a terrible crack, and a big chunk of cliff falls and buries the child. You know, this is in the opening pages of the book. But because Luda is a photographer, she has photographed the moment that it happens. Now, this ends up changing her whole relationship to the place. So what does she do?
Well, it's extraordinary to catch a moment like that. So the last moment of the life of this little girl before she's buried and killed by this massive rock fall, and her mother sees it happen and is totally distressed. And Luda, in her public role as a photographer, captures this very personal, tragic moment and publishes it because it represents to her the worst effects of climate change and the changes to our landscape. And of course, to her, this seems logical and important, but she doesn't think of the emotional impact on the grieving mother and the great disapproval it will bring her from her new community. I mean, all the people are shocked that she would intrude in this way.
But she's done it before. That's the thing. So it tells us so much about the eye that she brings to the world.
Yes.
Because she had taken a photograph of her son racked with grief for reasons that we're not sure of for quite a while, but he had been curled up in a dry creek bed or lake bed.
A dam.
And so this striking image of this beautiful boy and this wrecked landscape, and again, she had used it to make a point about climate change.
Yes.
And, I mean, it's such an interesting way to connect these stories, I thought.
Absolutely. And you can see what Luda's doing. And as a photojournalist, she's doing the right thing. But of course, I mean, her son doesn't forgive her for exposing his private grief. So she's very torn. She's kind of disconnected from her children because she sees them as part of the bigger picture. And I think she's protecting herself also from her own grief, her own problems, by looking through a lens and seeing the world at a slight distance and disconnect.
But the lens then fragments, doesn't it? So the book then takes us off in different angles as we get Luda's story, as we find out about this place that she's in and its mythologies and, well, and even that house that you mentioned, the ghost house. Mm. When people are near it, they can see the scars, or some people can see all the scars that you have ever collected on your body.
Yes. Luda and her son and some of the people who belong to the islands, when they come to Shawnee, something about the light and the history of the place makes these sort of gifted or haunted people look at other people's skin and their own skin and see the scars that they've been marked with right throughout their life. So it's almost like seeing the internal damage that's been done to them, the wounds that externally may have healed but are still there as part of them.
Wow. And is this connected to the house in some way?
Yes, it's connected to the whole island, which has a rather dark history too.
A history of witchcraft and witch trials. So this house is referred to as the ghost house, and it has witch marks on it, which were marks that the women who'd lived there had put for like protection against the evil eye or other forces. It's also the sort of place where stillborn babies would be brought and buried. So there's something about the history of both the house and the island that starts to have an impact on this story and this community. But remember, this is a contemporary community. But these superstitions and stories flow around them, and they particularly focus on this other character who we meet, this young man, about 17, whose name's Theo.
Mm.
So Where does he fit in?
Well, where does he fit in? Theo's a fascinating character. He arrived on the island as a small boy, probably about 7 years old, who was washed up and found by Ewan the fisherman and adopted or taken in by Iris, who's a good church-going citizen of the Big Island, and raised there. But a whole sort of legend has grown up around him.
Is he a Selkie?
What they all know. They all think he's a Selkie because he has webbed hands and because no one knows where he came from and he can't remember. And he's got this rather wild animal quality to him. He's illiterate, but he brings this magical quality to the story.
So he's about 17, Theo, and then there's the son Darcy. How old is he at this
time? He's 16 at the beginning of the story, which runs over about 2.5 years, the book.
Mm-hmm. And then there's Min, the daughter, who's younger. And
she's 14.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
And their stories all start to intertwine. So this boy who this local community think of as this sort of sea creature, it means that he's actually treated quite cruelly and is ostracised and teased. I mean, part of the reason he doesn't go to school is because of the way that he was treated. And so a friendship grows between the three of them. And it's a friendship forged by so many things, isn't it? I mean, how much is this a novel about grief, do you think?
I think it's very much a novel about grief. And increasingly we understand the layers of grief that are there. But there's the history of the women who've lost their babies. There's the women who've been persecuted and tried as witches. And 4 out of 5 women on this fictional island were executed as witches. So it's as though the whole community is grieving. And Eliza Henry-Jones has a background as a grief and trauma counsellor. And I think her PhD is particularly looking at grief connected with climate change too. And she's also done work in drug and alcohol addiction, and all of those things come together. So some of the characters are dealing with their grief by drinking too much, and
there's also a lot of alcohol,
and there's also an alcohol-driven sort of male violence on the islands, and all these things intersect.
And for part of the novel, I was getting this terrible feeling of foreboding because we don't know what had happened to this boy, the Australian boy, you know, that had left him curled up in the dam, grieving what his mother saw as climate change. But we start to get the sense that something pretty awful had happened to this child. And we don't know.
Because his dad's been killed in an accident, right? Is it?
Yes.
Right.
And we don't know how all these things interconnect. But the other one we haven't really talked about, though, is the teenage girl. She's sort of fierce. Yeah.
She is. I mean, where Darcy is a sensitive, somewhat damaged, bookish boy who wants to be a doctor, wants to study medicine, Min is bold and very physical and athletic, and she's kind of seems to have escaped the weight of the grief that is affecting her brother and her mother.
I wonder if we should bring Jackie into this conversation as well, because there are all these themes, whether it's of the whales or the marks on people's skin or on their houses, they could all be read as signs of grief and memory and the things that have happened to people. Jackie, I think you've actually had a look at this book as well.
Yeah, I'm only about halfway through, so don't tell me what happens.
Promise.
I mean, definitely layers of grief, but like Susan was saying, it's sort of like grieving for the world that we don't belong to anymore and we don't have a strong connection to. That's the vibe I'm getting. I'm kind of getting a couple of different layers of that feeling. And I don't know if Eliza intended this at all, but that's the beauty of being a reader. You can just read whatever you want into something. That sense of the disconnect from the feminine that the patriarchal history of the island imposed, making women sort of disconnect from their own feminine. And that's kind of the witchcraft stuff. That was the feeling I was getting. But then also all of the people's disconnect from the land because of climate change. And that seems to me like represented by the whales and the whales beaching and people being helpless to help them. I don't know. I'm getting lots of different layers of a longing to belong. And there's also that sense of, I get this from various books that kind of explore Scottish, Celtic, those sorts of histories and rituals and pasts.
And yet I guess she's reaching for it with these ancient stories and superstitions, well, that connect back to the older stories but don't quite connect back to religion. Because, Susan, one of the other characters in here is a really quite unpleasant character, is the local priest.
Yes. Father Lee is the villain of the piece, I suppose. He's the relatively new priest at the Kirk on the Big Island, but I think he senses that religion is losing its hold on people and he's trying to clamp down and keep out all these elements of superstition and magic and witchcraft. And it's as though the witch trials never ended in Father Lee's mind. He's still trying to repress these feminine qualities that erupt. And he's a dangerous character in many ways. I mean, he's a bit of a cliche, I suppose. You know, it's quite easy to make poor old religious figures into villains these days. But he is a very good character. He's a good blocking agent in the novel.
So how well then do you think she brings together these different strands, these ancient stories, these present concerns into a novel?
I think she's given herself a lot to work with. It's quite a complex set of almost different genres she's working with, from the gothic ghost story to the eco-thriller to the, you know, the family drama of trauma and young people growing up and so on. I think she's managed it very well, by and large, and I think it comes together in some very dramatic events towards the end of the novel. She has a lot of threads that she has to tie together and resolve in a rather extended ending, but she does it just enough so we understand, but everything isn't too neat. There's still that rather mysterious, magical element. Sometimes the tone switches a bit, and what I was expecting the novel to be wasn't totally what it ended up being. I mean, it was a much more grounded, earthy family story and a psychological story than perhaps I thought it was going to be with the suggestions that came up in the gothic beginnings. But I think she's done a very, very, very fine job of a very original story, really.
Yes, I liked the way that things like the scarring and the history that are both on bodies and on the landscape is all done without overplaying the symbolism of it. And so you come to accept some of that, I think, in ways that a lesser writer wouldn't let you do that. And that's Eliza Henry Jones' Salt and Skin, published by Ultimo Press.
You're listening to RN's The Bookshelf with me, Cassie McCullough, Kate Evans, as always, and guests, journalist and critic Susan Windham and novelist Jackie Bailey. And from a barely populated island above Scotland, we're heading now to the island of Manhattan in Sloane Crossley's cult classic.
Because we can never have too many books about New York, can we, Cassie?
We've had this discussion before. They get too many books about them, the New Yorkers. But having said that, Sloane Crossley is a very New York smart commentator and columnist for places like the New York Times, Vanity Fair, and Interview magazine. And her essay collections include I Was Told There'd Be Cake, and also How Did You Get This Number?
Isn't that a great title?
I think I've said both of those things in my life.
This morning.
Yeah, that's right. Before morning tea. But Kate and Jackie, this is a novel. Where should we start, Kate?
Well, the story really begins with a woman called Lola and a trendy restaurant in Chinatown. But before we meet Lola, and yes, she'll roll her eyes at you if you sing the Kink song along to her, la la Lola. Yeah. So anyway, but there's a prologue before we meet her properly, and it begins, there exists a contest among the dead. Each week they enter a lottery. What is this lottery and this story, Jackie?
Yeah, this is a very cool prologue, can I just say. It's the story that one of the other characters in the book, Clive, his mother used to tell him, I think, him and his siblings, that the dead enter this raffle to be able to spend a few minutes back in the living world at whatever time of day it is in that world. So if they do the raffle and you're Australian and they're on American time or whatever, then you might just pop back into your home for 3 or 4 minutes in the middle of the night, and you might just go and open the fridge and close the fridge. Or they give other examples of, you know, you might spend those few minutes at the photocopy machine, and these dead people will do anything to get a chance to just do really mundane things just for a few minutes again.
Tell you what, I wouldn't spend 3 minutes at the photocopy machine, but, you know, that, I'm just in the here and now, so I can't say.
But isn't it a fascinating idea that you just get this little three-minute slice and you can come back and revisit your life? And so, Jackie, I loved this opening, the voice, the oddness of it, the sort of almost arch tone from the narrator, and she's telling us about Clive. Although, as we read the prologue, we're not really sure who this narrative voice is, what her perspective is. So who is she? What's happening in her life?
Lola is a New Yorker drawing close to the age of 40. She's about 37 years old, and she's a freelance editor, I think. She had been working as a journalist and editor at Modern Psychology, which is, you know, a fictional magazine about psychology, but it's folded in the era of disintermediation. And so now she's working for some sort of online rag, and she's engaged to be married and just going about her life wondering if she's making the right decision.
Yes, she's engaged to a man called Boots. She uses his nickname. And as I was reading this, I realised that I'm quite put off by people using cute nicknames for their partners. But anyway.
You mean people in real life or novelists doing it?
Oh, both, really. Anyway, she calls him Boots. But then things start to happen in her life. And that night, Lola bumps into a really significant ex, a guy called Amos, who she had been with for a number of years. Mm-hmm. He's now, well, a sort of infamous, famous novelist. So what do we learn about her, Jackie, as she bumps into Amos?
Well, we learn how ambivalent she is about her engagement, how unsure she is, and we learn that she's a serial monogamist. She's had quite a lot of relationships in her time, and Amos was, I guess, the most recent significant relationship that she had. She's also, what I found really kind of interesting, kind of slightly off-putting to begin with, which I think was intentional by the author, was how Lola almost immediately wondered if they would sleep together upon meeting each other again. And then that kind of is off the table once he spots the engagement ring, and she wonders if it's because he's a good person or she's a good person, which, you know, is great to kind of introduce that element of, oh, do I like this narrator or not, so early on.
Yes, and it immediately raises questions about her relationship with her new man, Boots. And her problem with him seemed to be that he's too nice. He's too much of a good person. He's a glass blower. So, you know, they're full of light and air. I mean, and Susan's laughing, and it's deliberate. This novel is quite funny, and she's playing around with these ideas in this sort of smart set who aren't entirely young and beautiful, but they're still on the edges of it. Like, they're still pretty cool.
Like,
yeah,
us.
The clock's ticking.
Oh, yeah, like,
yeah, 37
exactly.
In New York. Better get a move on.
But then it keeps happening. Each night she ends up in the same part of town and she keeps meeting exes.
It's very funny. So this whole novel is fun, you know, and funny. And she does keep running into exes. Her fiancé has had to go away for a couple of weeks for work, and suddenly she's running into all these exes.
And some of them are sort of ridiculous, like the guy who was an Olympian and sort of beautiful and clearly just a bit of a dill. But the descriptions are hilarious.
Yeah, what's really fun also about the narrator Lola is she doesn't know why she went out with these people, really, like why she spent so much time with them. It was more like, oh, I'll just give this a go. Like, there's some part of her that thinks, well, theoretically, I should be able to go out with anybody. You know, the guy sitting at the end of this bar, if he's a reasonable person, I should be able to go out with him, make a life with him. Why not?
One of the things that she's saying in this book, I think, is that it often is harder for women at a certain age. So it's about dating in your 30s, and it's sort of on the cusp of doing a whole lot of internet dating and the pressures that are particular to New York, where it's both a huge pool and a small pool, because apparently it's quite a sort of aggressive dating scene. But it happens again and again and again, like every night, until we discover, Jackie, something else is going on. How would you describe the something else?
I've heard Sloane Crosley, the author, describe it, so I feel like this isn't a spoiler to say that it's like a mind control cult in the era of social media. That is what's going on.
So it's no accident.
It's no accident at all.
I think we actually should hear Sloane Crosley describing it for us. So she spoke to Claire Nichols from The Book Show for RN's Big Weekend of Books, and there's a point in the discussion where she went, mind control cult, and Claire sort of went, hang on, mind control cult? What?
Basically, so she used to work for a magazine, but in the book it folds, and her former boss is a man named Clive Glenn, who becomes one of these sort of larger-than-life cult of personalities, if you will. You know, his face appears on the side of tote bags, and he has a podcast, and he has this sort of like weird whole conglomerate life. And he has drank his own Kool-Aid in terms of his power, and he decides to found what is essentially an upscale Soho House-y kind of private club that also has cult-like aspects, more than a few. And what happens is after she runs, Lola runs into a few ex-boyfriends, her friend, who also used to work at this magazine, says, okay, this might not be a coincidence, come with me. And it turns out that Lola is being presented with a package where, in order to help gain closure, which is the purpose of the cult, it has a sort of eternal sunshine of the spotless mind thread or shadow running over it. To gain closure, she can possibly, if she wants, as long as she steps within a 5-block radius of this place, run into an ex. And it works via social media, power of influence. They have people on staff that are early employees of search engines. You know, she's their guinea pig, really. But if it works, they plan on charging people about $250,000.
$250,000 to come face to face with all your exes and your history and perhaps resolve something about your life. Now, she's not necessarily suggesting this is actually a good idea, but she is playing with it and sort of critiquing the whole idea of closure. I mean, I'm presuming, Jackie, that we're not expected to think this is a good idea.
I don't think you're meant to think it's necessarily a good idea or a bad idea. It's just, but it's ridiculous. It's a potentially realistic idea, I think, was what I found kind of, it wasn't too far from what I think search engines and, you know, the algorithms probably try and do now, you know, which is a pretty scary thought.
And do you think that's what she's wanting to deal with in this novel? Or is it a novel about love? Is it a romance? I mean, how did you read it?
I read it as a comedy, very much kind of like an inverted rom-com. You know, she's already got the prize. She's got the good guy. He does seem just like lovely and they do seem to get along very well. But she is going through all of her exes and trying to unsettle her own romance story. So I found that really fun, flipping the romance like that.
Mm. Yeah, it was fun. And then there's an extra twist at the end that we won't reveal, but that makes it quite sort of joyful.
So it seems to me it's a little bit in the genre that I think of as Black Mirror, that, you know, television streaming service show about the way technology changes human interaction and often to terrifying effect, but sometimes just funny. Is this a techno-psycho novel? Is that...
It's probably more of a social novel than those. So although it's touching on those things, she's really interested in people's relationships and friendships and in New York. So it's not as explicitly exploring those ideas.
Well, then is it a little bit like Nick Hornby and High Fidelity, you know, going back through his girlfriends and records and...
Probably an updated version of that. Or I was even thinking of Tara Isabella Burton's Social Creature, which is another one of those very New York novels. Jackie, how would you understand it? Like, where would you put it on a bookshelf?
Oh, you don't know what my bookshelves look like. So
all of our bookshelves are chaotic.
Wherever it'll fit. I don't know. I reckon it's kind of like one of those comedy of manners type books from, you know, like the importance of being earnest type mm-hmm. of thing, but set in New York in current times. Like, I think the technological aspect of it is really just for fun. I don't know, but I don't think Sloane Crosley is making a big, important thematic statement about the potential of technology to change people's minds. But I think it's more about how technology is an aspect of and a metaphor for the way that perhaps in New York anyway and in modern sort of high capitalist societies in the West, choice is endless, and we apply that to our love lives as well. Well, but choice isn't endless, really, and we're always trying to maximize rather than, you know, see what good is right in front of us. If there is any deep commentary, I think it's about that and about trying to separate your love life out from, you know, your habits of consumption.
And, of course, it does feed into books about New York and New York writing books about itself, which it has done for so long. Jay McInerney's Bright Lights, Big City is one of the ones that I always think of as a New York novel. Even Lee Tulloch's fabulous Nobodies, yes, actually. Susan, New York books?
Well, I lived there for 8 years and read a lot then. But just before I moved there in 1988, I had read Tom Wolfe's The Bonfire of the Vanities. And I must say my whole time there was kind of through the lens of this very heightened comic but insightful novel about New York society by Tom Wolfe, the great journalist and observer of his country. And, you know, I still think of the social x-rays, mm-hmm. the very wealthy, very thin Upper East Side ladies. And every time I took the road into New York from the airport, I'd think, oh God, are we going to take a wrong turn and end up in some outer borough that I don't know and get lost? You know, it's a cartoonish picture, but boy, he captured that 1980s wealthy,
yeah, well, that's
crazy
the sign
time.
Of great art, isn't it?
And Don DeLillo's Underworld, which started in the 1950s with a baseball game and was a wonderful portrait of New Yorkers and much bigger picture America. Cold War and all sorts, nuclear war and all sorts of things. And a book that I loved was Joseph O'Neill's Netherland. That one's about cricket. And, you know, for someone who has no interest in sport, I seem to be mentioning a lot, but that was a beautiful novel. Joseph O'Neill is Irish, but his character was a Dutchman who was living in New York after 9/11, and he joined the Staten Island Cricket Club with a group of immigrants, and it was just such a beautiful portrait of that mixed community on the outside of Manhattan. So, I mean, I could go on forever, but they were three that...
Oh, but there, it is such an interesting thing to think about the New York novel, because there are also, of course, terribly gritty ones like Atticus Lish, Preparation for the Next Life, Hugh Selby's Last Exit to Brooklyn. So it's not all glitter on the pavement.
No.
But this one is glitter on the pavement with maybe some other undercurrents. And that's Cult Classic by Sloane Crosley, published by Bloomsbury.
Well, thank you so much for those reviews, both you, Jackie Bailey, and you, Susan Windham. Just one or two books before we let you go. What would you like to recommend to us that's been on your reading list, Susan? I know it's an extensive one, so it's a very hard task.
Well, after Frank Moorhouse died last month, I went straight back instinctively to read some of his early books that I hadn't looked at for a long time. I haven't got to the big Edith trilogy mm-hmm. about the League of Nations yet, but some of the 1970s and 80s books, I think The American's Baby,
I love it,
Late Shows, and Martini, mm-hmm. which is a memoir, but all his work is partly autobiographical, partly fictional. And I was just laughing my head off. Gee, he gave me a lot of pleasure in that sad time when he died. Terrific portrait of sort of culture of the 70s, somewhat bohemian, some in an arch and slightly self-deprecating voice that is frank and yet is wonderfully comic and fictionalized. And, oh God, he made me laugh. There's one story in Late Shows about the narrator babysitting a friend's child where he has no idea what he's doing and no particular interest in children, but he's observing this little child. And I was sitting up in bed laughing. I had to explain to my husband why. Fabulous. I really recommend going back to Frank.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you. What else?
I'm actually rereading one of the books that was on that age shortlist for fiction, Cold Enough for Snow by Jessica Au. Now, I read it some time ago, but I'm talking to a book club about it next week. And it's a book of not even 100 pages, but it's got such beautiful depths in it that I think there's a lot to talk about, and I'm finding a second reading brings them out. It's the story of a young Asian Australian woman who takes a trip to Japan with her mother, who is from Hong Kong, and she hopes that this trip will take them out of themselves and allow them to become closer by travelling together and talking about important things and remembering her mother's life and so on. And what they find is it actually emphasises the distance between them and the differences. And her mother doesn't really want to look at tourist sites, all the things the daughter has prepared, she doesn't really care about. She wants to go shopping for souvenirs, and it gradually draws out the hard life that her mother had, and her intellectual privileged daughter realises how different they are. But it's a beautiful, quietly philosophical, almost a haiku of a novella is how I think of it. Beautiful language, quite grounded, but also very lyrical. And I'm loving it again.
And an outstanding title. I just love that title. And we read that one here, Kate, of course. Yes. What about you, Jackie Bailey? What else have you been reading lately that you'd like other people to pick up?
I absolutely second that recommendation for Jessica Au's book. God, it was beautiful. It felt to me like a book written in one sitting, which is truly impossible. I mean, I don't think I could bear it if she wrote it in one sitting. But, yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah. I read Jennifer Down's book, Bodies of Light, which I know is winning all the awards, but, gee, that was a gorgeous book. I mean, as someone who is a lot older than Jennifer, I just couldn't believe that she could go so deep into complex trauma if she hasn't experienced that herself. And I don't know if she has or not, but she just does it beautifully. So I really loved that book. Rhett Davis's book, Hovering, which is, I don't know what you'd call it. It's a little bit like magical realism, I guess, but with a bit of tech thrown in a fictional version of Melbourne, and the city keeps changing. Literally, the streets will just move and houses will just displace and replace. And that is kind of going on around this family of three people, a woman, her son, and her sister, her sort of long-lost sister. But whenever I think of that book, I think of the tree that they keep returning to at the river. I feel like there's a resurgence of trees in books lately. Authors are writing a lot about trees in a different sort of way, kind of as if the trees are talking to them and telling them what they need the writers to say or something. I don't know. That's a bit kooky, but that's what it feels like, and I'm loving that.
Mm-hmm. I immediately thought of Hannah Kent's most recent book when you said that. Yes.
Right. Yeah, Devotion. There's a few. There's
Devotion.
A few
Thank
coming
you,
out with that sort of theme. And the other one that blew me away was Ocean Campbell's book, The Silence Between Us. She and her mum, whose name I can't remember actually, but they wrote it together. And it's a memoir of when Ocean tried to end her own life as a sort of late teen. She's now in her 30s and happily married with kids, but they wrote this book together about that experience. And gee, it was profound.
What an extraordinary collection of books that you've both offered up for us. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Cassie.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. What a great conversation. Jackie Bailey is a novelist and an independent funeral director. The Eulogy is her novel. It was published in June this year. And Susan Windham is a critic and a journalist. She was literary editor of the Sydney Morning Herald for many, many years. And Kate, we've reached...
Well, yes, we've reached the end of another bookshelf, but we'll be back next time to talk trees and landscape in Australian fiction, as well as a new novel about Joan of Arc by Catherine Chen. And we'll also talk about Scott McCullough's Basin.
Well, that's it for now. I'm Cassie McCullough.
I'm Kate Evans.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.